From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter. Made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available on iTunes.
Welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble, and on today's show, we sample Clint Breeze in the groove, hear why you can't escape American Pianists Association fellow Sean Chen, and why you might want to wash your hands carefully the next time you visit the Indiana State Museum. And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All of that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today we'll hear a small studio session that includes a performer who's influenced by artists as diverse as Beethoven, Biggie Smalls, and Chick Corea. But first, a public radio contributor and a humorist who studied Jewish jokes walk into a bar. You may know Dick Wolfsey from his decades as a features reporter for Wish TV and from his Life in a Nutshell segments that used to run here on WFYI. In August, this writer and humorist debuted his one-man show, The Art of the Jewish Joke, at the Indie Fringe Festival. Contributor Mark Allen asked Wolfsey to talk about what the experience at the Fringe was like and to tell a few Jewish jokes.
Is it correct that you converted to Unitarianism strictly for the jokes?
Unitarianism.
Yeah, Unitarianism, okay.
You know, it's funny. I have a book of Unitarian jokes, and all they are is regular jokes where they stick a Unitarian in, and that doesn't make a Unitarian
it's
joke.
It's like one of those blank loose leaves,
yes,
right?
Yes. No, you know, Jewish jokes really are Jewish. Unitarian jokes are not Unitarian.
Yeah. In the one-man show that you did at The Fringe, you started off with a story about defining the word Jew. Tell that story, because I love that story.
Oh, gosh. Well, I have to tell it quickly. Well, basically, my rabbi came into the Hebrew class and asked. And
you're 13 years old.
I was probably younger. Yeah, okay. 12. And he was talking about the word Jew and how the word has been used negatively over centuries, even though it's a perfectly legitimate word. People are Christians, people are Jews. So he asked the class who in the class would be willing to go to Hebrew University. And, of course, everybody raised his hand. And then he said, to make his point, he said, who would go to Jew University? And I raised my hand. Nobody else did, but I did. And he kind of came over to me very curious, and he said, you would go to Jew University? And I said, yes, Rabbi, I would be. And the rabbi said, well, why? And I said, because it sounds like it might be cheaper. And, of course, he stared at me, and he said to me, and he sternly said, I want to see you after class. And, of course, the story I told, which is really true, despite some of the critics of the show saying I made it up, after class, he gave me a big hug, and he said, that's the funniest thing anyone ever said. And that was really cool, because I made the rabbi laugh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And you knew you wanted to be a comedian.
Yeah, and it was a great point.
Exactly.
And it was a great point, because the word Jew, you hear people on TV saying things like Christians, Muslims, Buddhists, and people who are Jewish are talking about this. What do you mean people who are Jewish? Jews. You can say Jews. Yeah.
What was it like to put together this show? Take me through the process.
Well, initially, honestly, I thought I would just come out and do what I do on television, which is just wing it, which is great if you're doing 2.5 minutes. But I'm doing 55 minutes. So I had a very good friend. I'll give him credit now, Len Mosey, who said to me, you've got to sort of rehearse this. So then what I wanted to do was basically try to do a combination of jokes and also sort of a narrative about the origin of Jewish jokes, how they differ from other jokes, and how they reflect the culture of Jews. This was a process not just of stringing together jokes, but thinking of a way to make it all make sense.
Okay. Tell the he had a hat joke, and then let's talk about the
oh wow
that.
Okay, sure. Well, basically the joke is, and it's a classic joke. The grandmother takes her booby, as they call it, to the seashore. The wave comes. I'm not going to tell it like I'd really tell it, but
no.
But the wave comes and takes her little grandson out to sea, and the grandmother says to God, "Please bring him back the way he was. And if you do that, I will become the best Jew in the world." You know, be kosher, go to temple, blah, 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 blah. So the wave comes and deposits the little boy right back in front of her. And she looks up to God and she said, he had a hat. Now, the thing about that joke that's so important is the line, bring him back the way he was. I've heard people tell that joke without that line. And that destroys the joke because the whole point of the joke is that she had an agreement with God. I'll do this for you if you do this for me, just like God had a covenant with the Jews when they left, you know, when they were in the Exodus, when they went to, you know, to the Promised Land.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, when we talked about this after the show and you said and I told you that the way I had always heard the joke was Henny Youngman telling the joke. And the joke was, you know, it was a lifeguard. It wasn't God who brought the kid back. And the lifeguard says, we saved your grandson. And the grandmother said he had a hat.
Right.
And you interpret that differently.
I think that's a horrible joke. The reason my version of the joke has some substance to it is because it's about the agreement that the grandmother has with God. In that joke, the grandmother is just a word I can't say on public radio. It's not funny. It's just she's ungrateful. Mm-hmm. And what's funny about being ungrateful?
Well, I think it's an expectation kind of thing.
Yes.
Like, oh, you know, you didn't do it perfectly. Which would be a very Jewish thing to say.
But if you ask people why they laugh at that, or tell me about the grandmother, people in your version of the joke, or Henny Youngman's, they'd say, well, she's ungrateful.
Right.
But in my version of the joke, if they thought about it, they'd say, well, you know, she did have an agreement with God. So I think that's a different interpretation.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Maybe Henny cleaned it up or something like that.
Right.
I don't know what that was. So you've done a lot of live TV, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
How does live theater compare?
When I first went on for the first time, I was nervous because I was thinking about, did I make the right decisions about how I put the show together and produced it and the graphics and all that kind of stuff. But the performing part was fine. Once I heard my first laugh, I felt really comfortable about everything. But I must admit that I was a little nervous about it. And I've done a lot of public speaking, too. But this was different. Here's the difference. A speech is different from a performance. This was a performance, not a speech.
Right. And you don't have notes when you're doing your show compared to a speech.
Well, that's right.
You might
and
have.
Also, a speech, people don't expect me to be funny. They're pleased and I am. But in a performance, I think they came to that for that reason.
My favorite Jewish joke.
Mm-hmm.
Car hits a Jewish man. The paramedic says,
right.
Are you comfortable?
I
go
make
ahead,
a living.
Finish it. Yeah.
I make a living.
Well, it's always, I make a nice living.
I make a nice living. I'm sorry to do that to you, but I have a thing about never hearing a joke I've already heard.
Right. that's my favorite. What's yours?
Oh, my gosh. I can't believe you're asking me that. I don't know how I can answer my you know, when you know literally thousands of jokes. I think my favorite one that reflects really Jewishness is the three Jews that are hiding behind a rock waiting to kill Hitler, assassinate him. He's supposed to be there at noon. He's not there. 1 o'clock, he's not there. 2 o'clock, he's not there. And the one Jew turns to the other and says, gee, I hope nothing happened to him. That's very Jewish, because if that was three Chinese people, Mark, that joke would not make any sense.
Right. Okay. Now, you know thousands of Jewish jokes.
Okay.
I pulled these Henny Youngmans. So I'm going to tell you the question. You tell me the answer. Okay.
Oh, gosh.
Let's see. Why did Jewish divorces cost so much?
Oh, gosh. I do know that. I forgot. Tell me it.
Because they're worth it.
But which is similar to the man who takes his wife out for the 50th wedding anniversary, and he says, what do you want, a mink coat, a diamond ring, or a Cadillac? And she says, well, I want a divorce. And he says, well, I wasn't planning on spending that much money. Similar joke.
Okay. Why do Jewish men die before their wives?
Because it's worth it.
Right. Okay, good. And why don't Jews drink? I had never heard this one before.
Why don't Jews drink? I don't know.
It interferes with the suffering.
Okay, that's good. I never heard that one, actually.
Yeah. And finally, I guess I should ask you, so what's the future of this show? Are you doing it again?
You know, it's interesting because despite the fact that millions of people in the area, I only, you know, totally attendance for the entire thing was like 700 people, which was pretty good. It was about full or three quarters full. So a lot of people haven't heard it, but Fringe people usually come back with a new act every year. So I will take this on the road, like to other temples, you know, outside of the Indianapolis area. But as far as Fringe goes, I'm still deciding what to do. Yeah, but it was fun.
Dick Wolfsey with contributor Mark Allen. You can see Dick's work weekends on Wish TV and read his column in more than 40 newspapers around Indiana. And he might reprise his Art of the Jewish Joke show, so keep an ear to the ground. Indianapolis-based hip-hop band Clint Breeze and the Groove is our October-featured small studio sessions artist, and WFYI's Melissa Davis has the story.
With seven talented musicians, Clint Breeze and the Groove is making a big impact on the Indianapolis music scene. Drummer Carrington Clinton explains how the band started out nearly 2 years ago.
My name is Carrington Clinton, a.k.a. Clint Breeze. I am the drummer and band leader of Clint Breeze and the Groove. I knew a lot of these guys from going to the Chatterbox or the Jazz Kitchen or the Mousetrap, and we kind of developed friendships. And we had two rehearsals, and our first show was at State Street Pub, and we played there, and pretty much since then we played, you know, a couple times a month on the regular, so.
Take that to the head. Sharp as a razor, sharp as a game of light.
The musicians share a love of jazz and formed over the genre.
So Joel and Nick, they have a band together, the Tucker Brothers. I've played drums with Premium Blend before. Other than that, we're all jazz musicians, so we kind of just, you know, we'll go to sit-ins. Yeah.
Carrington describes the Clint Breeze sound.
I was saying earlier, if the Roots and Hiatus Coyote met and, like, started dating, but, you know, that they just started dating, that's kind of where we're at right now in our sound.
The band is influenced by iconic musicians as varied as Beethoven, Biggie Smalls, and Chick Corea. Vocalist Theon Lee says music just kind of happened in his family.
And what's funny is, like, nobody was, like, a serious vocalist. Like, they could all carry tunes, but I just got used to, you know, singing and whatnot. And I remember my mother used to surprisingly listen to, like, a lot of house and techno. I just remember hearing, like, a lot of different things happening with, like, technology and whatnot, and then going back to hearing other people in my family who just listen to the radio.
Remember me? Was 5'10 with a big dream, dreaming of recording, trying to figure how to get seen. At 16, his worst battle was against Green. Seeing how you can't come up with cash is how you miss things.
Songwriting for the band is a collaborative process.
Nowadays, we're like writing songs together, and we're going deeper into the arrangement. So we're kind of evolving as like more of a collaborative effort as opposed to me just sending them songs and they learn them.
Crosswalks is a favorite composition of the group. Guitarist Joel Tucker explains the origins of the song.
So I just brought a riff to rehearsal one time and was like, hey, let's try playing this. And Nick started playing a bass line and Chris started playing some chords. And that's kind of how it started. Jared and Jay came up with a really nice horn line. And as we were playing, and I was watching Theon, and he was writing words while we were going through the music. That's kind of how that one came to be, and then kind of came up with the arrangement altogether. But it just started with a simple guitar riff, and it was in a different time signature, too. When I brought it in, we just completely warped it.
Runs out of magic.
Clint Breeze has more collaboration in mind as the band grows.
I really want to do an album where, you know, we write as a band 8 to 10 songs and then we take it to the studio and spend our time on it. So I think that's our next step, hopefully. You know, continue to play shows and continue to grind because this is what every one of us lives for, so.
You can hear more from Clint Breeze and the Groove at WFYI.org/smallstudio.
You ever ever see the sun get jealous because the moon was out? Just like gossiping only tells the truth of what you about. I know you heard, you almost 30 without a couch to whip. A 5-year business plan and a consistent relationship. Friends falling off because they loosen their arms and legs.
Melissa Davis with Clint Breeze and The Groove. Again, you can hear more at WFYI.org/smallstudio. And don't forget, Small Studio is made possible by a grant from the Herbert Simon Family Foundation and with support from Nito Art Shop and Sun King Brewery. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Just around the corner, pianist Sean Chen is everywhere in Indy over the next few months. But first, Eat Drink Indy's Jolene Ketzenberger talks with West Fork Whiskey's Blake Jones, who's opening a new distillery at 17th and Bellefontaine.
We're talking today with Blake Jones of West Fork Whiskey, a new distillery opening in Indianapolis. So let's start at the beginning. So when did all of this start?
Yeah, so it really started in 2014 when my partners and I cashed our 401ks and went out and got a loan and decided to start making whiskey. So that's when we officially started the company. You know, we thought it was a shame that so much corn went to Kentucky and Tennessee to make their whiskeys. And, you know, we're on the same water aquifer. If limestone water makes good whiskey and corn makes good whiskey, then there's no reason why Indiana shouldn't have some of the best whiskey produced right here. So that was kind of really why we started the company. We loved the spirit, thought the state really needed its own whiskey distillery that it could be proud of.
But the news is that the tasting room is open, right?
Man, it's been a long 2 years. So, you know, the laws governing distilling in Indiana are much different than breweries, wineries, and cideries. They can be open to the public immediately and have that consumer-facing brand right off the bat. Until this last legislative session, it was a 3-year wait until we could be open to the public immediately. So that's why, you know, we started in a warehouse on the north side. But, you know, we moved to 17th Bellefontaine and the Kennedy King neighborhood, a really up-and-coming, awesome neighborhood. Been fortunate to find that spot. And finally going to be, I hate it technically. Yes, it's a tasting room, but I hate calling it that because it really is a whiskey cocktail bar.
Okay.
And so we want to be known for both traditional and non-traditional whiskey cocktails, but whiskey. We say we're going to have a cocktail for everybody, though. You know, we're going to have traditionals, non-traditionals. It'll be a cool menu. I think, again, we'll have a cocktail for everybody, and it's only our stuff.
Now, what will people be able to find when they come to the new cocktail bar?
Yeah, so right now on the shelves, we've got 3 products. We've got an unaged corn whiskey, an aged corn whiskey, which is pretty unique because there aren't really many aged corn whiskeys on the market. You might find one other if you go to any liquor store around here besides ours, and a weeded bourbon.
Okay.
So those are the first 3 we have out. We're about to launch 2 additional products. We're about to launch Third Degree, which is actually a cinnamon-infused whiskey. One thing that, again, we don't want to ever artificially color, filter, or flavor our whiskey in any way. So if you look at Fireball and its 30 ingredients,
we were
like, why do people drink this? Why does this even exist in the market? Ours has 4 ingredients, simple syrup, our whiskey, you know, cinnamon sticks and dried red chilies. That's it. So it's going to be made in the right way. We got a rye-based bourbon coming out, just 2 ingredients in that, corn and rye. And then we have so 1 more coming out later this year is a traditional rye whiskey. We do have some specialty stuff put back, but I'll got to be hush on those for a little while. You know, we'll never buy a spirit from somebody else. Everything that you buy from us, we have done everything from mash to you know, age it, to bottle it, to everything.
All right there. Well, you said you were labeling bottles right before we were talking.
Sorry again for being a little late today, but we literally hand label everything.
So this is a real craft facility.
Oh, it absolutely is. We do everything, again, the right way, and we do it by hand. I mean, when we say small batch, some of our batches are as small as 160 bottles. So it's not like, hate to say it, Maker's Mark makes good whiskey, but they might have 15,000 bottles in a batch and call it small batch. There's no legal term.
No legal term, but yours really are small.
It's small. Oh, yeah. It's real small, which is good.
Has it been fun, though? I mean, it seems like it's kind of a dream that a lot of people have.
Hell of a lot of fun and so rewarding to build something from scratch or, you know, to go to a random Walmart in Lafayette and I see West Fork Whiskey on the shelf.
That must be cool. Really.
It's awesome. You know, again, this new cocktail bar and our new tasting room is only going to help us have even more fun.
Well, now, where can people find more information? They can find you on social media?
Yeah, at West Fork Whiskey on all social media. We don't really tweet, but we love Instagram. We love Facebook and www.westforkwhiskey.com.
What are the hours going to be for the new whiskey cocktail bar?
Oh, man, I may have this wrong, but we'll be closed Monday, Tuesdays for now. Open at 4 on Wednesdays and Thursdays till 9. 4 to 10 on Fridays, and I think on Saturdays and Sundays opening at 1, Saturdays closing at, I think, 8, and Sundays maybe closing at 6.
Oh, well, goodness. So people will have plenty of opportunities to come in and check it out.
Absolutely. Hope they do, and hope they do it often.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
You can hear Jolene Ketzenberger's Eat, Drink, Indy Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI, HD2, The Point. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and coming up, Fountain Square hosts a monthly comedy hour. But first, the 2013 American Pianists Association Classical Fellow Sean Chen will make several visits to Indianapolis this year and next, starting with a solo concert on November 19th at Indiana Landmark Center. WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer is here to tell us more about this talented artist.
And this is a wonderful collaboration, too. It's between the APA and the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra. And Sean was in Indianapolis for a day a few months ago, so I invited him and ICO conductor Matt Kramer into the studio to tell me more about their collaboration.
Well, we were talking to the American Pianist Association about a way that we could really immerse a bright pianistic talent here into the community and perform in multiple venues and capacities. And it just through brainstorming, we thought, of course, Sean, we have to bring Sean back in. Our audiences love him and it provides him the opportunity to play solo repertoire, chamber music repertoire with ICO musicians, and then present him in a concerto in front of the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra. So this kind of immersion, to really saturate, I think, the music scene here in Indianapolis is something that we really had foremost in our mind.
How do you stay creative and excited about performing every time?
It is a challenge, I think, and not so much for me. I don't play, 100 concerts a year or something like some of the other pianists do, but every performance I try to take in the hall, the different piano. I mean, meeting a different piano is like meeting a different person. They have different characteristics, and you have to approach them differently. And so combine that with, trying to mix up with different pieces. I get excited just thinking about playing piano, so it's not too much of a problem for me, but I think it's a combination of also not practicing too much, but thinking more about the music rather than just, rote physical practicing at the piano. So more seasoning of the material than it is grinding it out. That's my strategy.
What do you hear back from your audience members, from the people that come to your shows? Are they interested and excited about collaborations like this?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's really the way forward for all of the arts organizations in Indianapolis because we can really cross-pollinate with our audiences. We're able then to explore ambitious projects, something like this, to have Sean in Indianapolis on 3 different occasions throughout the 17-18 season is an incredible opportunity for anybody who loves music. And for us, then, it's also a way to show at the Chamber Orchestra that we have worked with so many different organizations in the city and continue to between the Symphonic Choir, the Violin Competition, of course, the APA, who is one of our best friends, and a number of other organizations. We find that it really benefits everybody.
And Sean, after winning the APA in 2013, how have you seen yourself improve and grow and change in ways that maybe you didn't think were going to happen?
Well, playing so many concerts really does help you grow, I think. Because you're playing the same repertoire over and over again, you really have time to think about it and kind of have a goal of what you want to do, or you listen to yourself and after every performance and you evaluate and you kind of really act as your own teacher. I think a lot of the changes are maybe not so apparent to myself, probably more apparent to other people and audience members, but that's okay. It's sort of part of being a musician and developing. So,
And Matt, you've obviously heard Sean many a time since then. Where is he on his growth pattern and everything?
There's still tremendous growth for Sean, but at this stage of his career, his artistry is just it's amazing, really. When I worked with him almost a year ago, it's been on the Rachmaninoff Second Concerto. I mean, the audience was it's for such a familiar piece. It is a war horse, but the audience was blown away by the kind of the freshness of it. That it did seem like it was a work that was just newly penned and full of life. So I've heard him on a great deal of repertoire, and I find that his ability to communicate, you know, effectively with a work that's 300 years old versus one that's brand new, and the amount of repertoire he has in his fingers is very, very impressive. So I'm excited for Sean now, and I'm excited for Sean in 10 years to see where his career goes.
And those challenges obviously have to, like you said, keep you interested and engaged and continuing to perform.
Definitely. It's a never-ending goal. You know, perfection is unattainable, but we always try to go towards that, and it's a lifelong journey.
And Matt, you actually get to make some music with Sean during one of these performances.
I'm delighted about this. Absolutely. I get to dust off the violin and join in on the chamber music program with three of my ICO colleagues, our new concertmaster, Tarn Travers, principal viola, Chabra Daly, and Margie Hanna, our principal cellist, will all be joining in. They'll be performing throughout the program with Sean, but I'll join him on the second half for this great piano quintet. And just to begin the opportunity to actually physically make music as opposed to wave my arms around silently in front of a group of musicians, which is terrific. You know, I get to stand in the middle of the sound. But this is something that I've looked forward to. And when any chance that I do get to collaborate on the violin with my musician colleagues is rewarding for me very much.
And I would guess that you will take something out of that experience that you'll be able to insert again when you're conducting as well, being a performer as well.
That's right. It is very important. And I've always been taught this, and I do convey it whenever I'm in front of conducting students, is never lose your connection to your instrument. You always have to be making music. And it gets quite difficult. I haven't practiced in weeks, for example, because the conducting schedule just hasn't allowed me to. But when I do have free time, I'm always very cautious to stay in shape, because it's not like riding a bicycle. I mean, it's really maddening, because I can hear it in my mind what it should sound like, but what comes out, you know, even my one-year-old kind of runs from the room if it's been a little too long between practicing. So it is very important to stay physically in touch with it, because, like you said, you get back on the podium and then you just have different ears, I think, when you're actually able to make music yourself as opposed to just conduct.
Uh-oh, Sean, are you afraid of his joining you? You're going to have to whip him into shape during rehearsals, perhaps?
No, it'll be great. I'm really looking forward to it, too. It's actually a piece that I've always wanted to play. And it's going to be a pleasure having him join us on that piece.
I won't be in conductor mode at the time. I'll be in violin mode. So I'm a very agreeable colleague.
Sean plays the first of his three performances on November the 19th, as we mentioned before, and then he returns next year. He's coming back January 27th and March 18th, and it's during that last performance in March, that's when Matt's going to get the violin out and join him on stage. That'll be a fun evening for them and for folks in the audience, too.
Absolutely. Can't wait for all those performances. And by the way, we have some other performances and art exhibits and other just generally fun things you can do on our calendar we call
What'll We Do?
Indeed, the Follow the North Star programs are among the most popular at Connor Prairie, and they're back for the year. You can follow the North Star and find out about traveling back to the year 1836. You're going to assume the role of a fugitive slave seeking freedom on the Underground Railroad throughout the state. You're going to travel as part of a group, and you'll encounter a variety of characters ranging from sympathetic allies to racist antagonists. Very powerful experience, great thing to do with your kids or kids in your life, and you can find out more at Connor Prairie's website.
On Wednesday, November the 8th at 6:30 in the Central Library in downtown Indianapolis in the Clues Auditorium, it's writer-author Laura Numeroff. And if you have a kid or a niece or a nephew or a grandchild, you know she wrote that book, If You Give a Mouse a Cookie. She wrote that many, many years ago. It's in its 60th printing. She's now in the fourth in her series, and this one's called If You Take a Mouse to the Movies. And, of course, she will be there speaking about her career and some of the other interesting things that she does. She does a lot of work with service dogs as well. And a portion of the sales of her book royalties also go to a group called First Book, and they're a nonprofit organization that makes sure children who can't get new books get them. So if you have some time, it's a free discussion with Laura Numeroff, 6:30 Central Library on November the 8th. And if that doesn't give you enough selections, you can join us next week as we check out our calendar that we call What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Coming up, you say poison, and I say medicine. But first, once a month for most of this year, brothers Brock and Cody Benefiel have been presenting and participating in comedy shows in the Wheeler Community Arts Center in Fountain Square. The Fountain Square Comedy Hour features sketch comedy, storytelling, and stand-up, and sometimes music, too. Brock Benefiel joined contributor Mark Allen in the studio and, with Cody on the phone, talked about the origins of their show.
So, Brock, I have known you for 10 years at least, and if somebody had asked me to describe you, I would have said, reserve, businesslike, a good student. I mean, you were an OR fellow, you were an intern for the IBJ, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, what went awry?
So when I was told you were doing comedy in Fountain Square, a mutual friend of ours told me that, the first thought was, well, he must be presenting it or booking it or doing behind-the-scenes stuff. He's not doing comedy. So I was a little surprised about this. So tell me about you and comedy.
So I never made you laugh at all for 10 years?
I don't remember that being part of your persona when we were in class.
Yeah, you know? Well, I waited a long time to do it. I didn't. So I do stand-up now, but I didn't start doing stand-up until I was 29, which is very old, you know, in terms of when people typically start. They usually start in their late teens or their early 20s. But it's actually my brother Cody that co-created the show with me. He was doing some open mics for a few years, and then got into improv comedy. And it was writing jokes for him and having him reject those jokes was the reason why I wanted to get on stage and do it. But I've been a fan of comedy my whole life, so always something I wanted to do, but just didn't think I could do it until I got on stage and I mean, I still can't do it well, but until I got on stage and tried.
It's the hardest art form, I think, because it's you against them.
Right.
That's it. And you don't – all you have is your weapon is the microphone. So let's say that the funniest brothers in comedy are probably the Murrays, right? Bill and Brian Doyle Murray and Joel Murray and Chris and Tony Rock and the Smothers Brothers, right?
There
so let's say that the least funny brothers are the Sklar Brothers, who are not funny at all. In that spectrum, where do the Benefiel Brothers rank? And let's start with Cody since he's on the phone.
Oh man, there's no way we're even as funny as the Sklar Brothers.
Oh no, don't say
I
that.
I don't know. Yeah, I'm not sure if we come up on this ranking.
Well, I think we're like the Sklar Brothers though. We're big fans of the St. Louis Cardinals, so at least maybe we're on the same level.
Okay, no, all right.
Cody won't put us higher.
That's too bad. Okay. So, well, tell us about the shows in Fountain Square. How did they come about?
Well, we were, like I mentioned, I was doing stand-up. Cody was doing improv. And we loved doing shows individually. But we got the idea last December, Cody and I were at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater in New York. And we went to a show, like this midnight show. And the show was great. But afterwards, all these performers were hanging around and drinking and having a good time. And we thought, man, it would be fun to put on a show where it's just all of our really talented friends so that we can get them together in the same room, have them perform, and then have this great night out. And so we got the idea to
do the show, and then we just started to piece together all the different forms of comedy that we love. So we do sketch comedy on the show. We do stand-up on the show. We have storytelling. Sometimes we have music, which is not comedy, but sometimes it's musical comedy. And so we just started piecing together all the things that we wanted. And we wanted to do it in Fountain Square because that's where our friends were loving to hang out. And when Cody and I were doing open mics, we would take our friends, and they would just be so impressed by the local talent that otherwise they hadn't been seeing. So that was kind of how the idea germinated. And then Cody had a friend, actually his improv coach, that was starting the Long Shot Theater at the Wheeler Arts Building, and they were so kind to let us be one of their first shows to launch there.
Yeah. So tell us about the next show that's coming up. It's November 18th,
yes.
Right at the Wheeler,
yes,
Center.
So it's going to be our sixth show, and we're going to have new original sketch comedy, and Cody's writing and directing that and putting that on. And then John Hancuff from Bloomington is going to be our headliner, so we're really excited about that. But if you come to the show, you're going to see great stand-up, great sketch comedy, and great storytelling.
Yeah, and for $5, it's hard to beat
that. For $5, exactly.
You know?
It's a cheap mistake, if nothing else.
And when you were deciding on this, did you think of a traditional route? I mean, did you think, well, maybe I'll go to Morty's or Crackers or something like that and do stand-up there? Or have you done that?
We haven't approached anyone other than the group that we're with because I think Cody can agree, we wanted real creative control over this and we wanted to make sure we could pick the acts. So for us, it was better to launch it with an independent group.
The next Fountain Square Comedy Hour is Saturday, November 18th at 8 o'clock in the Wheeler Community Arts Center in Fountain Square. Tickets are just $5. Check out Fountain Square Comedy Hour on Facebook for more information. The Indiana State Museum is playing host to a new exhibit called The Power of Poison. And in it, you'll find everything from live poison dart frogs and a tarantula to legends, fairy tales, and medicine. I invited Dr. Mark Siddall, who developed the exhibit for the American Museum of Natural History, and Damon Lowe, ISM Senior Curator of Science and Technology, to tell me some of their favorite parts of the exhibit. Okay, Mark. When did poison come into your life?
Well, the exhibition Poison came into my life in 2012, more or less, and then we took about a year, for example, to put the exhibition together. It opened in the Museum of Natural History in New York City in November of 2013.
Okay. So tell me about the steps between becoming a scientist and organizing a museum exhibition.
I'm a parasitologist, and I started getting interested in parasites when I was an undergraduate, did my graduate work at the University of Toronto.
Why?
Why did I get interested in parasites?
Yeah.
Oh, they're fascinating. I think there's something interesting that's connecting there with poison, too. They're unseen. There are lots and lots of parasites and parasite life cycles. We don't really see them all the time, but they're actors out there in the natural world. And the same thing goes with poison as well. It's an unseen actor in a natural environment.
So you wanted to figure out how you could see it, how you could track it?
They're just mysterious, and I think anything mysterious that you don't see very easily is fascinating to some people.
Yeah. So who came to you and said, wow, we should assemble all these pieces of information and make an exhibit?
We do these things at the American Museum of Natural History by committee. We have a group, a really good group, that gets together and tries to bounce different ideas off each other. An incubation group. And we even topic test some of these things, and poison seemed to resonate pretty well. You know, when I was a kid, I thought natural history museums was where you put all of the things that were too venomous to show live in zoos, so like the snakes and so on. So I think it's a natural fit for us. There's an interesting component to the exhibition in that we also talk about the human connection to poisons and how that's influenced literature, how the other edge of the sword of poison is how we've used them for drugs.
Yeah, the good.
Yeah.
The happy angel instead of the devil on the other shoulder. This is a question for both of you. So it's a big step from taking this complicated subject matter and making a family-friendly exhibition. Damon, why did you think this was a good fit for the Indiana State Museum, in particular for families?
Well, when you go through the exhibition, you see that there's all kinds of really interesting components, and the interactives, I think, were some of the most wonderful parts of it, and especially the Enchanted Book. And if you see the kids interact with it, they have a great time, and it's hard to pull them away from it.
And so you're a scientist. Again, you're taking this very high cognitive stuff, and you're figuring out how to interpret it for kids.
And yet, you know, scientists aren't necessarily the first ones that have done that. Sleeping Beauty is technically about poison, right? They put her to sleep, and then she comes back. Romeo and Juliet, the same thing happens. Is that possible in the real world? Turns out it is. We call it anesthetic. The Witches of Macbeth, sure. Sherlock Holmes, Agatha Christie. Poison is this really cool, exciting thing that has been part of history telling. It's been part of fiction. And in fact, we use that as a leverage point to get kids interested in science, because round about the beginning of the 20th century, the heroes of these stories, like in Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's books, are the scientists, the forensic toxicologists. And then the people who come through the exhibition get an opportunity to apply their own skills as a scientist, as a budding scientist, in one of the interactive things towards the end to try to solve cases of poisoning.
What are some of the misconceptions about poison and poisonous animals, organisms that we have that might or might not be debunked by this exhibit? I haven't been through it yet.
I think the obvious one for me as a biologist is the idea that venomous organisms are out there to be aggressive and to kill prey and so on, or to mess with us. Now, the truth is that the most venomous and sometimes the most toxic animals that we find in nature are that way because they're trying to defend themselves. Mm-hmm. Even diamondback rattlesnakes, which are incredibly venomous, are that way because there are opossums that can feed on them with impunity. So the opossums try to eat the snakes. If they get bit by the snake, the opossum kind of just goes to sleep, wakes up and looks for the snake that it bit earlier. Hopefully the snake is dead, and then it goes and eats it. So there's been this evolutionary arms race where the venom gets stronger because the resistance of the opossum gets stronger, so the venom gets stronger, and so on and so on and so on, until you have these incredibly powerful toxins. But it's all about the snake trying to defend itself, not trying to be aggressive to other things.
It's not by nature out there to come after you.
No, I mean, snakes would rather just be left alone. Most people who get harmed by snake bites, it's because they picked up the snake.
They're messing with something they shouldn't mess with.
Exactly.
What are some positive ways that we've used? I mean, you know, there's a branding issue here. You could call it poison or you could call it medicine. One of those has
sure.
some negative connotations. But what are some of the entities that we used to think of as bad that are now used for positive in medicine?
Well, at the very end of the exhibition, when you walk into the Poison for Good section, and there is a section, it's actually called Poison for Good, there's this huge yew tree. And yew trees are known and have been known for a very long time to be toxic, and not dangerously so, but you'll get sick if you try to eat yew leaves and so on. And yet the substances from the bark of yew trees were one of the first big blockbuster drugs, Taxol, for helping people with breast cancer.
Oh, wow. And you know, I think all the time about who discovered that this was helpful, how many people had bad effects before the good was figured out. But that's the only way forward is experimentation.
It's experimentation and hopefully doing it at small scales before you get past the point where it's an overdose. So
yeah.
There's a lot about poison as target. I like chocolate. Do you like chocolate?
Of course.
Well, you don't want to give chocolate to your dog because
no
for
pancreas,
dogs,
right?
I'm not sure exactly what the reason is, but they can't handle the theobromine. That's the actual compound that's dangerous to a dog. It's slightly stimulating to us.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, something like onions and garlic are toxic to cats. Thankfully, cats don't eat plants, or they shouldn't be eating plants. So there's an element of what's the target organism and is it toxic to that? And then there's dosage. So salt is something that you need in your body in order for your nervous system and your muscles to work. But a cup and a half of salt is probably going to make you really sick.
Hmm. There's a saying in gardening, right plant, right place. So you've kind of expressed that, the right amount in the right place.
There you go.
Favorite part of this exhibit?
Aside from the Enchanted Book, which I think is fabulous, I really like the poison dart frogs, which are not actually poisonous in the exhibit.
Oh, darn it. I was hoping.
But there's a cool story as to why.
Okay.
Yeah, well, they're poisonous in the wild because of their diet, but when you raise them in captivity, we're feeding them fruit flies or crickets, so they're not toxic.
What do they eat in the wild that makes them poisonous?
A certain type of beetle.
Oh.
So when they're eating in the wild, that makes them toxic, but when you raise them in captivity, they're harmless and very cute.
I should have told the listeners with kids to cover their kids' ears so that we didn't take the mystery out of the poisonous dart frogs. You can't have a favorite part. You love all of it.
That's like asking which one's your favorite child,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
No, I really like the exhibition through and through. I'll tell you something that I think, about the exhibition that is sort of a knock-on effect about it. Just the way that it's structured, I hope that children, adults, adolescents walk through this and wonder, oh, my God, what book am I going to read next? Because there's really a lot of, whether it's a science book, a natural history book, or, you know, go reread the Macbeth or something by Agatha Christie.
Or write a book,
exactly. You know, in New York, when this got shown, I got invited by a group of people to come and talk to them about poisons. They called themselves Sisters in Crime. It's a bunch of women who are crime writers, and they wanted me to give them new ideas how to off their protagonists.
Dr. Mark Siddall developed the exhibit, The Power of Poison, for the American Museum of Natural History, and Damon Lowe is the Indiana State Museum's Senior Curator of Science and Technology. That interactive, enchanted book of ancient botanical knowledge brings to life poisonous plants people once believed possessed magic powers. You can see The Power of Poison, if you dare, at the museum right now. More info's at indianamuseum.org. Every week, a Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long talks five songs with someone from our community. Here's this week's journey.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto. I'm here with Ari from FAF Collective, a music journalist in FAF. Tell us what FAF is, Ari.
FAF, that's short for FASAFAS, and so it's a local publication. We're online and print, and we publish everything from poetry to reviews to opinions. We feature photos. We really are artists trying to get the word out about what's going on in our city.
Yeah, it's not just music. You also have critiques of different social issues
right.
here in Indianapolis.
Right.
Yeah. Do you want to give us a taste of what some of the issues are you might be addressing on FAF?
Well, definitely the housing crisis that I feel like is going on, also known as gentrification in the city. The food crisis, just a lot of the crises that are happening in the city, if you didn't know that it's a crisis going on.
All right, and you brought five songs to share with us
yep.
today. Do you want to, like, frame these songs in any particular way, just five songs you're enjoying at the moment?
Well, so, yeah, some recommendations, some are just kind of, like, current. So I'll start with the first one.
Sure.
First one is Address by Currency. It's off of his Pilot Talk tape, and he was just here last night.
At the Emerson,
at the Emerson,
right? Yeah.
And it's, like, a thing with my sister and I. We go, like, every year. So this is, like, my third time seeing him, so wanted to shout that out because it was fun, like, performing that with him last night. Catch a crook in your neck from trying to watch the jets. Mr. Tokyo Drift spang in on the vet. Looking for shit, but you take one guess. She caught up in the rapture. Waking and baiting the nigga, the greatest hits blasting. Pedal mashing, paper twisting, scraper engine. Red racer, no 3D glasses, just air say hi. The second one is Nothing to Free by B. Kool-Aid. It's off a dope project called Brown. It's super, super cool. BRWN. So check that out.
And what is it about this piece that grabs you?
Well, the album itself is just dedicated to brown skin, to being a person of color. And I love that itself. And then the lyricist Pink Sifu and the producer Ali, they are just so amazing. And the sound really appeals to me. It's like smooth like honey. And then Them Changes by Thundercat, which is just a great... I just love Thundercat, so that's something I've been grooving on. Mm-hmm.
number four.
Rasta Time by HR. It's off of one of his solo albums. I just love HR and all his solo projects. HR was the frontman of Bad Brains.
One man fetch a bucket, another man fetch a pail, but it's the stone that the builders refuse. Shall be the head cut stone in Rasta's eye.
And then the last one, On My Way by Rio Cragen. It's just like a new track that I came home to today, and it's pretty cool.
Oh, no, oh, no. Don't you look back, no, don't you slow down. Don't you look down, we're at new heights now. All on my feet and my heart. I'm on my way, on my way.
Ari, remind folks where they can keep up with FAF and you online.
So you can check FAF out on all social media at FAF Collective. The website is FAFCollective.com. If you had a question or wanted to contribute, please email us at FAFCollective@gmail.com. And then I'm Ari Attack, so you can holla at me on my social media happy place on Instagram at Ari Attack.
Thank you, Ari. Appreciate it.
Yeah, for sure.
Hear Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Wednesday nights at 8 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today's contributors included Mark Allen, Melissa Davis, and Jill Dittmeyer. Hear The Art of the Matter Saturday mornings at 7 or join us Thursday nights at 8. And remember, you can listen to and share our podcast, and we hope you will, at WFYI.org. Next week, Arts at All Saints, Winter Lights, and Books, Booze, and Brains. And of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call What'll We Do? All of that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.